Autism is a bioneurological developmental disability that generally appears before the age of 3. According to the National Autism Association, autism affects 1 in 36 children, and boys are 4 times more likely to have autism than girls. We know that feeding disorders are very common amongst children with autism, and mealtimes can be extremely challenging for parents. Often, the traditional methods for helping kids accept new foods won't work for kids with autism. So how can pediatric providers help parents expand their child's diet variety without creating stressful and traumatic experiences at mealtimes? Well, my friend, with consistency and a whole lot of patience. I'm Colleen Sloan, an RD turned PA, and this is the Exam Room Nutrition Podcast, where each week I'm giving you the nutrition education you never had in school to help you become a more confident, compassionate clinician. In today's episode, with the help of registered dietitian Bretta Ahlstrom, we'll teach you 2 proven methods of diversifying a child's palate called food chaining and sensory progression. We'll also discuss key nutrients that might be missing from a child's diet. Now, maybe you've looked at the child's growth chart and said, well, they're at the 75th percentile, so they're fine. Meanwhile, all they eat is chips and cookies. So we'll teach you exactly how to support the family and provide helpful recommendations regardless of where the child's weight falls on the growth chart. You ready to dig in? Well, I am so excited to welcome back Bretta Ahlstrom. Bretta joined us in episode 29, where she unpacked some myths regarding sugar, dyes, and ADHD. So if you didn't catch that episode, be sure to check it out because 30 to 61% of children with autism also have ADHD. Bretta specializes in pediatric, integrative, and functional medicine for neurodivergent children. She operates a virtual private practice called Neuro Nutrition KC, based out of Kansas City, that prioritizes family health and wellness for children with complex health needs. You can follow her on Instagram at the Neuronutritionist. Bretta, I'm so excited for this conversation. Thanks for coming back. Welcome back to the show.
Yes, I'm so excited to be back. I love this next topic.
Yes. So, you know, the challenges are unique to kiddos with autism and no 2 kid is alike. So what might work for one patient might not work for the next. So let's introduce what those feeding challenges are. What is unique to kiddos with autism?
So I would say a majority of this uniqueness really comes from like the sensory differences that you might see. And this is something that most clinicians aren't necessarily prepared to address or to even like think about because it's not one of those core things that we're assessing generally. But outside of sensory differences, we also have a little bit more food anxiety. This is a really gray area on where is it related to autism and where might it kind of bridge into that eating disorder category and more present like ARFID. And then we also have cases of really poor interoception or heightened interoception where we just don't have great cues happening in our body. And we can talk a little bit more about that as well. And then too, the routines and liking to have a stable routine. And not all kids are, you know, as bound to a routine as other kids are, but for some kids, it really does matter. And they need to be prepared for all the things happening in their day. And we can address all of those things through strength-based supports and really tailoring our nutrition recommendations to those strengths that we're looking for.
So when you say those, they're not as in tune to those food cues or feeding cues, what do you mean by that? And what does that look like for the child?
So interoception is kind of like this additional sense is generally how it's presented, where it's like, you know what's happening in your body. You can feel, you know, that you have a headache coming on. A really great example for some kids with autism is actually potty training. It might take a little bit longer, whether or not you're just not working on those things because you have too many other things going on, or that it's really hard for them to kind of grasp some of those cues. So they may not know when they have to go to the bathroom until they are going to the bathroom. They still might not really notice that they've like even gone to the bathroom. And that varies based on the person. But that is that same feeling. And I think that's easy for everyone to grasp for when you, you know, feel your stomach growl or you're like, oh, I'm getting hungry. Or you can feel your mood change in relation to like, you know, maybe having a little bit of a low blood sugar. And you might be able to identify those things really well. And some people might not be able to identify those things really well. They might just feel not as good, or they might be having like different behaviors or experiencing different behaviors as a result of some of these things with like not really a good idea of why that's happening.
Last time you were with us and we talked about ADHD, we did discuss the difference between macronutrients and micronutrients. So if you haven't listened to that, go check out that previous episode. But For autism specifically, I wanted to start with discussing some micronutrients or key nutrients that might be helpful for them or that might be missing out in their diet. So can you give us an overview of what those might be?
Yes. So this is actually really interesting. So there are some studies out there that are like, hey, look, like we looked at kids who are taking supplements and they're still deficient in some of these nutrients. So I believe about 56% of kids with autism were taking some multivitamin or another supplement. But 1/3 of them were still deficient in vitamin D. 54% of them were still deficient in calcium. And then those who were following like a specialty diet, like, you know, maybe they were gluten-free or dairy-free, their supplementation use really increased. It was like about 78% of those kiddos were taking something. And so the things that they were still ended up deficient in, even with supplementation, were vitamin D, calcium, potassium, pantothenic acid or vitamin B5, choline, and iron. So we need to make sure that we are getting in a wide variety of things. So I always recommend making sure that if you are doing a multivitamin, that we're actually getting a high enough dose of that multivitamin to fill in a lot of these gaps. Or if you need something a little extra, that's totally fine too. But when it comes to the food, when we look at iron, obviously, meat is a great source of iron. Our leafy greens are a good source of iron. But on the flip side of that, when it comes to selective eaters, those are two foods that are generally more likely to be off limits for that particular eater. So if we're looking at how can we improve your nutrition while we're working on your diet quality and your diet variety, I actually often recommend fortified cereals. So Quaker Oat Squares, Frosted Mini Wheats, even Rice Krispies. You can make some homemade Rice Krispie treats, and that can be a great way to start supplementing that iron. So those are things I recommend looking for families to start out with. And then when it comes to zinc is really challenging. It's high in shellfish and meats and other fortified foods. And so again, those are commonly foods that might be a little bit more off limits, but looking for those fortified foods can be really helpful to get in enough zinc. And then we've got magnesium, which can be found in beans, nuts, greens, and grains. Magnesium isn't always super easy to get in food. So that's something to just be aware of. And it does have a lot of positive benefits for managing behaviors, which it's not on the list of foods that kids are commonly deficient in, but there are a lot of therapeutic benefits to making sure you have adequate magnesium. Same thing with vitamin D. Vitamin D can be really hard to get through food, as I think everybody knows. And those core foods are going to be eggs, fish, and fortified dairy. If a child's drinking whole milk, that can be a super great source of vitamin D, but we do need to make sure that they aren't drinking too much whole milk. Otherwise, we run the risk of that iron deficiency, so with the increased calcium. And then omega-3s can also be really helpful as well, which we talked about a little bit in our ADHD talk. But you can look at just doing, they make gummy fish oils now. You can offer fish like tuna, make a little tuna salad, see if that goes over well. And then you can also use a little bit of like chia seeds or flax seeds, incorporate those in like different foods, yogurt, smoothies, things like that, and see if we can get those into our body that way.
Super interesting. So during a well check, I'm not expecting clinicians, you know, to say, hey, you need all five of these micronutrients, but you can suggest that, hey, maybe you can try to incorporate some beans into your child's diet, because then they're going to get some protein, they're going to get some iron, they're going to get some magnesium. So that's like a really great suggestion that you can provide to your parents to hopefully introduce some of these different nutrients in their diet. And again, every child's different. They might love beans and you've got a win right there, and they might not. Sometimes you can try it differently, right? Beans come in all kinds of ways. You can make black beans, kidney beans, chickpeas. You can throw chickpeas in the oven and make them crunchy and salty, right? There's lots of different ways to incorporate food. So even if the child tried one type of bean, it doesn't mean that they're not going to like it another way. So parents and pediatricians, don't give up. Continue to try foods different ways for the child, because you never know what they might like and what they don't. Mm-hmm. So let's move on to a really big topic about autism, and that's weight. In clinic, I've noticed either kiddos on one side that are hovering on the overweight obesity section, and then on the way other end of the growth chart, and that's underweight. So how can we address weight and autism and those specific needs, whether they're overweight or underweight?
Is it? Yeah. So first and foremost is making sure that we're doing those things to make sure we're getting enough nutrition in. So the nice thing about high and low weight is that the strategies don't change all that much. So we really want to focus on those mealtime routines. If a child has poor interception where they don't have fullness cues, that can often lead to those higher weights. And then we can start to build in some additional supports to help them with that. So that might mean higher protein. It might still mean a little bit higher fat. So we can actually create those fullness cues. It might be setting time limits on how long we're eating for. So there's a lot of different things we can do on the higher weight side of things, which are generally the same thing for what we're doing on the lower weight side of things too. So we want to make sure that they're getting enough protein, enough calories, and enough of those micronutrients, not just for weight and growth and development. And I know that in pediatrics, growth like is the metric, but we want to make sure that they're getting well nourished. And so regardless of where they are, if they're a selective eater, refer them to some sort of feeding therapy would be incredibly helpful. And that would also help make mealtimes easier for families and just the overall family experience a little bit more pleasant. And then you still might need to use like an oral nutrition supplement for a child that's higher weight, just like you might need to use an oral nutrition supplement and a multivitamin for a child that's lower weight.
Yeah, I think you said it really well. Sometimes as pediatricians, weight is the end all be all. You're like, oh, they're at 75th percentile. They're doing great. No problem. I don't even need to discuss nutrition. But really and truly, their diet is so non-varied and they're not getting really any micronutrients at all. So don't just solely focus on the growth chart, although we talk about it so much and it is really, really important. But for those kiddos who might be, you know, just floating right along in that middle section, we still might be missing out on a lot of really healthful feeding opportunities. So don't miss out on that.
I also have kids that are higher in weight, but also have very low appetite and really like high food selectivity. So they're really like not getting in any nutrients. Like they might eat like 3 Doritos and a cheese stick every day, but their BMI might still be at the 90th or the 85th percentile. So it's definitely not that hard black and white.
It's so interesting you say that because I actually see that more often. And this might be for kiddos who don't even have autism, but I have a lot of families and kids and the parent says he doesn't really eat anything. And like you said, it's like Doritos and cheese sticks, but they are at the 98th percentile. Why is that?
So a couple of things here. One, if you, as like the obesity evidence kind of continues to unfold, having enough nutrition is super important for adequate metabolism. And then having the right kind of nutrition is super important for altering that gut microbiome. And so as the gut microbiome evidence continues to unfold too, there's differences between people who easily maintain a normal weight and people who might be at a higher weight too. There's differences in their gut microbiome. And so if we're not doing anything to improve the gut microbiome either, then we might still stay at that higher weight.
Yeah. It's just so common that parents, and it's, I see this in teens, you know, I don't really eat anything and yet they're very overweight, faltering on that obesity side. And it can be really frustrating for them because they think they're not eating a lot, but they're gaining weight. And so it can kind of be this confusing thing where I say, well, you need to eat more. And they're like, what? Yes. Why?
Yeah. Well, and if you think about too, like how all those micronutrients come through as, you know, in regulating that metabolism. And if you don't have those and you're still going to be, you know, yes, like eating is important for maintaining a healthy weight. And even if you look at some research with diet, it's so hard to get all of the DRIs for micronutrients met from eating even a 2000 calorie diet per day. I think it's like 3,500. And then it's like, you know, a lot easier to meet all of those things. So, you know, we do need enough food in our body to fuel everything.
So I love this conversation because I think this will be super helpful because I in clinic literally deal with this every day. So helping our listeners understand how they can explain this better to their patients is very helpful. So now we've talked a little bit about weight differences with autism. Now let's move into the very, very selective eaters because mealtimes are extremely stressful for families. Oftentimes, you know, there's so much food anxiety regarding meals and sitting at the table and new foods being introduced. And on your Instagram page, which if you aren't following her, please check her out at The Neuronutritionist. You can also find me on Instagram at Exam Room Nutrition. But Bretta, you go over food chaining and sensory progression methods. So I love these two methods and I think they're super helpful. But if you could just explain what they are in terms that clinicians can then explain that to their families, I think that would be really, really beneficial for families to start incorporating.
Yeah. So with food chaining, I think food chaining is the more abstract of the two. But with food chaining, we're basically trying to go from what is the preferred food and what is a goal food and how do we get there? What are all these steps in between of foods that we can gain in between? And in my practice, all variety is good variety. If we get another kind of cracker, we get another kind of cracker. If we can eat a food that's the same food, but it's prepared in a different way, like we're building that neuroplasticity, we're getting that flexibility and we're getting that variety. And so all variety is good variety. But when it comes to food chaining, for example, we might take a Dorito and we might go from a Dorito to Bonito, which are like the chips, you know, that are made from beans. They have a little bit more protein in them. They have the same texture. They have a similar flavor profile. They might appear a little bit different and they might have a slightly different taste. But we're looking for foods where we can change just one of those sensory inputs there. And then we can continue to move that down the line until maybe we can actually eat a bean. I think the simplest example is going from a yogurt, like a plain vanilla yogurt, to going to eating a strawberry or something. So we can go from a plain yogurt, and then maybe from that plain yogurt, we take a spoonful of a strawberry yogurt, or just a yogurt that's pink, but it's still the same texture. It has a slightly different flavor, but it's the same, you know, the consistency is the same. And then we could go from a pink yogurt to a yogurt that maybe has some of those small fruit chunks in it. And then from that, we would dice up a strawberry really fine. And maybe we add like one or two really tiny pieces of a strawberry. We'll make those chunks bigger over time. Then we can look at dipping our strawberry into the yogurt. And then we can have our yogurt and a strawberry separately. And so that's the idea of food chaining, that we're making those little small tweaks there. When it comes to sensory progressions, this is much more simple. And it basically runs through each sense. So what we want to do, and it depends on the child and how far they are, but we want to meet the child where they're at. So we want to take them one step further than what they're comfortable with. So for some kids, they don't want a food on the table. They don't want it on their plate. They don't want it anywhere. So that first step in that sensory progression might actually be having the food stay on the table. The next step might be having the food stay on the plate. Our third step is generally like touch. And so that could be, can you play with it? Or it could be moving it from your plate to a no thank you bowl. And then from touch, we're going to go to smell. And then we'll move through to kiss. We'll stick our tongue out and do a taste. And then can we put it in our mouth and we can spit it out? Can we chew it? We can spit it out. And then can we chew it and swallow it? And those would be the sensory progressions to get there. The biggest thing for me, though, when you're doing sensory progressions, is that the expectation of what the child's supposed to do is really clear. So I have a lot of families that will come in and they're like, well, we're doing that. And they're like playing with it or whatever. But the expectations aren't clear. So the child doesn't really know what to do. They don't know what's expected of them. So if it's today at dinner time, we are going to have strawberries. We're going to put the strawberries on your plate. If you don't want to eat the strawberry, that's totally fine. You don't have to eat the strawberry, but if you don't want it on your plate, you need to pick it up and put it in the no thank you bowl. And so making those things really clear and then maintaining those boundaries, you know, as you go through meal times is really important for making progress. Just like with anything, like in parenting, it depends on how old your child is, what their developmental age is, but like you have to meet them where they are and make things clear.
So helpful. I love the food chaining concept. And I'm going to go ahead and link to more details on that down in the show notes, because this is something pediatricians can incorporate, whether the child is neurotypical, autism, ADHD, selective eater or not. It's so helpful to get kids to try new foods, because we know kids like consistency. They like their foods and they like it because they like it, because it doesn't change and they know exactly what they're going to get. So it is really hard to get them to go from a yogurt to strawberry, but that's such a good example and it can be done with any and all foods. So food chaining is so helpful. Now, what's an expectation of like, how long is this food chaining process take to go from the yogurt to a strawberry? What is an expectation that we can present to our parents?
It really depends on how committed and how much time the parents have. And I don't want to be like, oh, it's like a downfall on the parent. Like, it's hard. It's hard, first of all, to have a child with a feeding disorder, and it's hard to do the therapies. It's stressful. There's a lot of things that we can do to make mealtimes less stressful, and having less stressful mealtimes actually improves the outcomes. But it will depend on how selective your child is and how creative you want to get to. So I would say, for like a new food, for someone who's like incredibly selective, it could take up to 6 months with a food. But the more that we try things and the more that we start to gain food, it's like a snowball effect. It's not every food won't take you 6 months to gain, but it after that, like stuff starts to get easier.
Yeah. And I think setting that expectation is really important. And, you know, feeding kids is hard, whether you've got typical kids, feeding disorder kiddos, autistic kids, it's just hard. Parenting is so hard. So mm-hmm. I think too, as clinicians, if we can just take the guilt and the pressure and the burden off the parent and say, hey, you're doing a really great job, but if you wanted to help your child eat a little bit better, here's a few things that you can try, right? Because they have so many other things going on too at the same time, but food and feeding is usually their top priority and is the most stressful aspect about raising a neurodivergent child. So how can we help the families start to have anxiety-free food exposures, because this is a huge thing. It's so triggering to kids see a new food on their plate and to be told, eat this, you know? So what are some strategies that we can suggest to our parents to do?
Yeah. So first through play, that's the easiest way. So even if you have maybe like some fake foods, plastic wood or something like that, and then you can do some pretend eating, we like to do it away from the normal mealtime space. And I get that that might vary based on, you know, family. Some people do have like a nice table, other families don't. That's totally fine. But we want to have the experiences outside of that mealtime, because sometimes that mealtime environment is the stressor and it's going to prime some of the stressful behavior. So if we can get some of these wins away from the table, that's going to serve us a little bit better. You can get your child involved in cooking, which I think can be really fun. If they get to choose the ingredients that will go into something, they might be a little bit more likely to try it. It just depends on, you know, it's not for every kid, but giving them some opportunities to not only explore with food, but to also build their autonomy too is really huge. I know a lot of times we put our neurodivergent kiddos in a box and we don't challenge them and empower them to, you know, develop a lot of these skills. And it's something that can be really helpful. And then the other thing that I like to do is sensory experiments. So finding ways for kids to interact with foods in maybe a sensory bin. Maybe we're starting with dry pastas in a sensory bin and you can put some of their favorite toys. Like if they like dinosaurs, we can toss in some dinosaurs in there and they can go excavate and go find the dinosaurs. And then they're getting that exposure to pasta. And then we can progress from the dry pasta to maybe partially dry pasta and partially wet pasta, cooked pasta. And then we can go from that to a full bin of cooked pasta. And then we can start offering cooked pasta at our mealtime. So there's some things like that that we can do to offer food outside of the table, offer it in a play setting, and really get, you know, experimental with it. You can do painting with dips and sauces. Some of this stuff can add up and it can get expensive, but, you know, getting something like a phyllo dough, and then you can paint on the phyllo dough, and then you can cook it and have a snack. Like there's just a lot of stuff you can do to get creative in the kitchen. And it's a lot of work, which is partially why we do feeding therapy, is so someone else can do the work for you. But those are some good options to start introducing foods in a way that's less stressful for kids.
No, I love that. And I loved discussing the aspect of play with my parents, because we forget that as adults, right? We forget that food should be enjoyable and that they should love to be around it. And it is a sense of community. And just think of how we as adults like it, right? Date night is like the best night of the week, because you get to sit and just relax and enjoy the company of others with good food. So helping children learn that is so important. And we also forget that trying a new food and learning to like a new food isn't linear. They don't just go from like, oh, it's on my plate, I'm going to taste it and try it. Oh, I like it or I don't like it. It's not linear at all. So that's why I love that sensory progression method, because you talked about, hey, can you touch it? Can you squish it? Can you draw with it? Right? That is the process of learning to like a new food. And I'm so appreciative that you brought that up. And I really hope that clinicians will start to encourage parents, hey, yeah, the goal is that they will eventually eat this food, but it's a process, and enjoy the process over time. Take the stress off of forcing them to eat that food day one of learning this new skill. So I would love to end with you suggesting something that clinicians should never say to a parent or a child who has autism. So I love this question, because it's like the reverse of our recommendations. So what would be the most harmful or least effective suggestion that clinicians could provide that we should absolutely avoid?
I think we're starting to move away from this as a group, but people will go, well, just don't feed them and they'll eat. There's some strategies that might have been like historically more effective for kids that aren't neurodivergent, but they're not as helpful for our neurodivergent kiddos as to just not provide them food or to just offer with the family's eating and to not provide them any preferred food. So if we can always incorporate a preferred food, that's ideal. But a lot of times people will say, just make what you're making. And, you know, if they're hungry, they'll eat. And that's not really true for our neurodivergent population. Just remember that all of your neurodivergent kiddos are going to be different and they all have different needs and we can use different methods for everybody. And it's about finding about what works for that child.
Yeah. And I think you made that really clear in the beginning because they don't have those feeding cues like the rest of us have. So that's very unfair to the child. And I think you're referring to the take it or leave it concept, right? I think I grew up with that. It was, you know, this is dinner, take it or leave it. And yeah, sometimes that works if that works for your family and you've got neurotypical kiddos. I agree. You shouldn't be a short order cook for your family, but it doesn't always work for those neurodivergent children. Retta, this has been so extremely helpful. And I know my listeners have so many things that they can now suggest and incorporate into their well checks for kiddos who have autism. So I'm so grateful for you giving us the gift of your time. Thank you so much for being here, Retta. We would love to have you back on. It would be absolutely my joy to learn from you again.
I would love to. Thanks so much for having me.
All right, guys, now it's time for my nutrition notes. Today, I'm going to leave you with a nutrition tip, and I wanted to explain to you how do we start the process of food chaining and then give you a few more examples of what it looks like. So step one would be to have your parent make a list of all the foods and drinks that the child accepts in all atmospheres. So for example, what does the child eat at home for breakfast? If the child goes to daycare or school, what foods will they accept in that food environment? What foods does the child eat for lunch? What foods does the child eat for dinner? And then also including any beverages and snacks. Step two would be to review that list and look for patterns in flavor, texture, shape, temperature. And you're going to find new foods that match the child's preferences in flavor, color, temperature, texture, and shape. It sounds simple, but you can really expand their food preferences over time when you choose foods that they are likely to be successful with. So now I want to give you a few different food examples and how food chaining would work so that you can provide this to your parents. So one example is if you want the child to go from chicken nugget to either grilled or baked chicken or grilled or baked fish. So chicken nuggets are tricky, right? Because most kids only like one brand, one shape, one texture. And this is where you're going to want to start to change things slightly. So if your child only likes the one brand of the dinosaur nuggets, that's okay. You can make those dinosaur nuggets and maybe throw in one or two other smaller, regular circular nuggets or long stick nuggets so that they can get used to seeing a new shape mixed in with their dinosaur nuggets. And if they accept that, then the next food chain you're going to do is offer them only the straight nuggets or only the circular nuggets. Once they accept that, then you can move into maybe offering chicken tenders or breaded fish sticks. Once they accept that, you can move into removing the breading. So only grilled or baked fish or baked chicken. Another one of my favorite ones is to go from cheesy crackers to broccoli. So if you know that your child likes cheesy crackers, offer them a similar thing, but a new shape. So if they like goldfish, try to offer them Cheez-Its or buy a different brand of those cheesy crackers. Then the next step in the food chain could be if you crunch or crumble those cheesy crackers so they're almost like breading and see if they'll eat them that way. The next step would be in those little crumbles or within that little breading of the cheesy crackers, you can put very few tiny pieces or strips of a broccoli florette in there. And the child can almost use it like a little dip, or they could just see the broccoli in there and not even taste it, but just so that they're exposed to that new food. As they learn to accept a few bites or tastes of broccoli, you can increase the size of broccoli, sprinkling the little cheesy crackers on top. Then once they accept that, you can totally remove the cheesy crackers, and now your child is hopefully just eating broccoli. Thank you so much for joining in today with me, guys. I hope you found value in today's conversation. I would love if you could share this podcast with your colleagues so more people can find my podcast. And that's all for today, guys. So as always, let's continue to make our patients healthier, one exam room at a time. I'll see you next time.